Hi everyone, this is Serhat. My guest today is Evgeny Gökberk. He is the founder and managing partner of V7 Capital, which is an investment firm focused on liquid decentralized finance investments. Hi Evgeny, welcome to the Curious Learner.
Hi Serhat, hi everyone, thanks for having me.
You are one of those people who moved from traditional finance into crypto, and you did this a while back. You are from the early cohorts. What attracted you the most into crypto?
Yeah, you know, I admire people who jump straight into crypto from TradFi. I think they're very brave. I had an intermediate phase. About 7 years ago, I started learning about fintech because that felt like a very cozy, you know, transgression. Then I had an enterprise blockchain phase. And only then I jumped into crypto and into DeFi. And, you know, it was a very scary journey because you're leaving a very comfortable world of regulatory cushion into a place where no rules exist and there is no one to complain to if things go wrong. But looking at this retrospectively, it actually looks like a no-brainer, because the thing that gave me enough courage to jump into DeFi was just pure excitement. Because in my mind, DeFi was the first use case in crypto which I actually felt real about. Everything before that felt exciting and interesting, but not tangible, because, you know, there wasn't a tangible business model necessarily. There wasn't a business that can be built. There wasn't a cash flow that can be derived from doing something on the blockchain. But with DeFi, when you actually, you know, start playing with it, I got extremely excited because I saw how the whole financial system can be rebuilt. And that's pretty exciting. And once you feel that level of joy, you suddenly forget about fear.
Once you do that, there's no going back.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm yet to meet someone who went into this industry and then went back. This doesn't really happen.
So the real use case, if you think about crypto in today's market, but DeFi actually still seems to be the strongest use case. Or everything else seems to be a bit on shaky ground, right? There is a lot of push to build that perception. Here is a use case of, you know, NFTs. But DeFi has been performing regardless of what's been going on. Do you agree with that view?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And what happened over the last few months is a great testament to that. So in crypto, we've seen, you know, obviously market crash is completely unrelated to the technical performance of the technology, right? Which is, we understand that. And then we had a few blow-ups in the space. A few, you know, a very large hedge fund blew up. A couple of very large lenders blew up. And one stablecoin blew up, as, you know, among the famous ones. And the interesting thing is that most of those blowups happen in what is called CeFi, you know, centralized finance, which is a prop shop, a hedge fund, a lending desk, whilst their equivalents in DeFi performed extremely strongly with no bad debt sitting in the system. And to people who look at the collapse of Terra stablecoin and equivocate that it's a feature of DeFi that things eventually or occasionally blow up, I actually have a very different view to that, because in my mind, DeFi is not about individual projects. DeFi is about technical ability to build financial processes. So if I come and I deploy a set of financial logic, which is flawed, then I might go bankrupt, even though technically it did exactly what it was supposed to do. So in my mind, the collapse of the Terra stablecoin is actually a proof that DeFi works, because the stablecoin did exactly what it was designed to do in a specific financial outcome. So in fact, their smart contracts performed extremely well under pressure. It's unfortunate that those smart contracts drove a lot of value to zero. But that's a little bit different from saying the technology doesn't work. So technology worked extremely well. The market is extremely robust, and it's actually quite notable that even those firms that have blown up over the last few months, the first thing they repaid were their DeFi positions. Because it is relatively easy in an unregulated industry to overlever 5x without telling people what you actually hold, but you can't negotiate and lie to a smart contract. So if anything, DeFi performed extremely well.
I think code is the law actually continues to perform well for DeFi protocols, which is really promising for the future of crypto. You've been in that transition as an intermediary step into fintech first, which looks like helped you. And a lot of people that I speak to from the crypto industry, they talk about this period of unlearning, right? Mm-hmm. So all their experience, all their learnings from their past, which obviously shaped their careers, they had to unlearn a lot of that. You know, yeah. They had to almost clean their mind first before mm-hmm. they learn about DeFi, they learn about crypto. Because admittedly, and from my personal experience as well, it takes a big mindset shift. It's not only about reading white papers and trying to understand the technology. Obviously, you can do it to some extent, but just that is not enough. In particular, if you want to work in crypto, if you want to build a career in crypto, you have mm-hmm. to, you know, do that mindset shift. Was that the same experience for you? How long did it take for you to adjust as you came from deep corners of traditional finance?
You know what? Realistically, it took me 2 years of full-time thinking about this. So I wasn't working in crypto, but 2 years I was just trying to learn about this. It took me 100 meetings, 20 conferences, dozens of hours of reading material, and eventually playing in the space. And I think it's very hard. Probably, like, I can immediately think of like at least three reasons. One, it's a completely different business model. I come from the buy side, so hedge funds, wealth management, where you sit in a closed structure and you have your clients and you have your trades and you have your processes and you just execute. And, you know, that's finance, right? You have to execute extremely well, quite a narrow set of tasks, basically. And yet in crypto, you know, there is kind of nothing to execute because no one tells you what you need to do. These are open communities, open business models, open innovation networks. And it's such a radical shift because in a closed environment, you shift into an open network, which takes a huge shift. Secondly, you know, technically, it's really complex, especially if you don't come from the software background. So, you know, I come from pure kind of finance economics, and understanding what a smart contract is took me a long time. And then you try to participate. Like, I tried setting up an Ethereum node back in 2015 or 16, I couldn't understand like some code, like some what do these letters mean? And it just takes a lot of education to at least understand the basics. And I think the final point, which is probably it was the main challenge for me. I think most people in traditional finance, especially if you're on the investment side, you know, your job is really about risk management, about minimizing downside and avoiding looking like an idiot. Like this famous phrase of, you know, no one ever got fired for buying IBM. It's a good phrase for a reason. And everyone who worked in finance experienced it in some shape or form. Whilst, you know, venture, fintech, and especially crypto, it's about having exactly an opposite mindset. It's about, the job is basically, you know, you have to look like an idiot until you're right. And it's a very different mindset. It's a very different attitude towards risk-taking, whether it's, you know, literally an investment or making business decisions. And it took me a very long time to just break my mindset, because it took me a long time to realize it's not about avoiding mistakes. It's actually literally about embracing them. And the more mistakes you do, you know, the more mistakes you experience, the better you actually perform. For me, that was the biggest shift.
Awesome, Eugen. And I think obviously the ability to contain those mistakes to minimum damage is probably what takes you forward. Looks like I'm sure you've done it very well in your career. Hence, you know, Re7 Capital is growing. We will talk about that. But again, if you still stay in the early days of your crypto experience, how did the industry evolve since you entered the space? And you can take this question from obviously a number of different angles. But what's been your key observation? Was there anything, you know, surprising as such? Obviously, you were new to the space. Not necessarily you sort of visualize everything in your head as to how things could develop in the future. Nobody would expect you to do so. But what's the biggest observation? Maybe you can start from there.
I think the biggest one is how more tangible things have become. I remember in 2015, you know, going to some Ethereum meetups and trying to barely grasp the concept of what it is. And then you have these people who are very excited about the space and they're telling you stories how this will be the operating system of the world. And you're just like, well, okay. So like, what can you do there exactly? So it shifted from those high level stories about the a vision of the future towards today, where with inefficiencies, of course, you have real businesses built on the blockchain. So right now, if you want to get a loan on the blockchain without talking to anyone, you can go and do that. If you want to trade, if you want to publish your IP if you want to, you know, buy someone's piece of art or music or something else, if you want to make a payment, so on and so forth, right? I'm just obviously throwing the obvious examples. So we really migrated from building that infrastructure layer to there being real use cases and millions of people actually, you know, click the buttons and do something every day, just like they do on their phones or, you know, in their normal lives.
Awesome. And that, you know, clicking one button and, you know, making things happen is obviously, it talks a lot to, you know, customer adoption and, you know, widespread sort of adoption of crypto. Although that also means there could be some security issues, which obviously there are, as we've been, you know, seeing over and over again. I don't want to, you know, yet get into, you know, the security issues just yet, but how did you sort of, again, remaining on this topic of evolution of crypto since you entered the space, on the security side of things, when do you think it starts to become an issue maybe? So obviously, you know, in the very early days, it's a very small space anyway. So, you know, there's not a lot of people, you know, doing transactions. Hence, you know, security, nobody even, you know, considers security, right? So why would it be important? And in fact, I was on one of the previous episodes of the Curious Learners, I had Munir Ben Shemlet, founder of Paraswap, Dex Aggregator. So he was telling me the stories of early days of his business. He said, he was first, you know, monitoring the number of people, number of individuals, you know, using the product, and then the transition from there to actual volumes traded. So that's when, you know, you see the development. But in those early days, when you have, you know, a number of people there, you know, playing around with your protocol, security is not an issue. But what's your sort of take, maybe overall, again, in terms of the development of sort of security as a concept in DeFi? Because, you know, if we are talking about this becoming an asset class, you know, to your point about risk management as well, this is the, you know, critical issue, or one of those under risk management anyways.
Yeah, security is paramount. You know, I remember the first time I saw Vitalik speak in 2015, it was a meetup where he spoke about security risks, and he went through dozens of case studies how you as a user can lose your money. So I looked at that like, okay, I'm going to lose everything. So that's clearly going to happen. So I would argue that, you know, security has always been an issue in this industry, and it will continue to be an issue for a while. It's just that it also matures over time. So there are, you know, first and foremost, you need to know what you're doing, because there are different types of risks, right? We've seen numerous cases where people, you know, store a lot of valuable coins in their personal wallet that sits in their browser. Imagine if someone comes to you and says, hey, you know, you have your savings at, you know, JP Morgan, UBS, and whatever. Do you want to keep them in your browser, on your laptop, or on your phone? You will probably say, well, are you crazy? Right? You wouldn't do that. But people often treat crypto money as video game money, even though obviously it's very tangible and it's very real. And, you know, it may feel like video game money when you make it, but when you lose it, it feels equally real. I can tell you that from experience. So a lot of it is just discipline, being common sense kind of driven. There are obviously massive institutions with billions of dollars sitting in the space who are using very robust custodial solutions. And just like anywhere else, again, you need to know what you're doing. With DeFi specifically, that's probably, as you know, as a firm and as a team, 90% of the time that we spend is thinking about the security risk of specific protocols and smart contracts. And it's a very specialized niche and a very specialized job to do that. And we probably can't expect too much from DeFi. So DeFi is, you know, a set of financial protocols that have really existed at scale for 2 years. And scale, again, being a very generous word. So you can't really expect a whole new financial ecosystem built with beta software, effectively, like raw software, to be fully robust. And the odds are, if you are just someone who's starting to play with the space to learn without doing it full time, the odds are occasionally you will put your money into some code without understanding what it will do exactly. And that money will be taken from you by some hacker or by whatever else. But it depends on how you treat it, right? If you want to learn about the space and you have, you know, $10 or $50 to play with, then you can go and you can experiment, and you know, you basically take it as, you know, cost of education. If you're doing this professionally full time as a money manager, then you need to have a robust risk management system, which is where, you know, kind of looping back to the TradFi mindset becomes quite useful.
Absolutely. And in fact, you must have obviously followed the news around this latest exploit in the Solana ecosystem. These wallets being drained. And it was quite ironic because I was on this Twitter spaces late at night in my time in the UK in London. It was 2 in the morning. And there was this, you know, spaces with 2,000 people. You know, these are all, not all of them, but there are all these DeFi maximalists. You know, their motto is not your key, not your coins. Yet they were suggesting to people to move their funds to centralized exchanges, to Coinbase. That was quite interesting when I was listening to that. So still, from a security perspective, there is huge gap between CeFi and DeFi. And obviously everyone is aware of that, and people there were suggesting to people to move funds to Coinbase, which obviously it's not their favorite platform in the first place.
Yeah, you have to compromise a lot, right? It's a very imperfect industry, and you have to be flexible with how you approach things, for sure.
Until you build the robust, you know, framework for DeFi itself, which I guess we are progressing well, but still, you also mentioned that DeFi is still what, 5-10% of the total volume anyways, so it's still very, very small. And I guess the important thing is perhaps to build those protocols, security frameworks, whatever it takes, sooner than later, because when things become much larger, then obviously the damage due to an exploit and hack hurts much more.
I agree, but also, you know, taking a step back and looking at it statistically, I think at the peak of DeFi market, we had 300 billion, maybe 350 billion sitting across various blockchains in DeFi. And roughly, I would argue from memory, probably 3 or 4 billion has been stolen in total since inception of DeFi. So it's obviously a massive number, but we're talking about less than 2% of total assets. So thinking about this purely from a kind of mathematical logic perspective, you know, it sounds very scary, and it is scary if you don't know what you're doing. But statistically speaking, your rate of default has been lower than on, you know, high yield bonds.
Sure. No, that's absolutely right. We see a lot of examples of exponential growth of volumes of engagement with different DeFi protocols. Again, if you try to maybe go back to early days, what was the consumer need, did you think, DeFi protocols addressed back then, and the use case more broadly? Clearly, there is this financial gain that people who know what they're doing can make out of these protocols. But otherwise, for an ordinary person on the street, what's the use case of DeFi?
You know, that's a very good question. Crypto is obviously great from a technical innovation perspective, but also it has a lot of economic innovation involved in that. And, you know, thinking to the early days of DeFi or the early days of just crypto trading, I think the real first use case, as, you know, cynical as it sounds, was speculation. And it doesn't sound great when you say it, but the reality is that, you know, things like casinos exist in the world because they facilitate a certain need and they meet certain demand. And speculation is obviously that on steroids. When DeFi, however, started to emerge, you know, at first it was only used by a very small group of people who are already in the space. They have quite a bit of these coins and they just wanted to do something. You know, they were intellectually curious to play with this experiment and test this out. And then things like, you know, arguably synthetics was the first to incentivize these, you know, reward campaigns. But Compound, this, you know, lending marketplace, really took it to the next level in June of 2020. And that was basically a very simple model that revolutionized the whole DeFi and brought it from 100 million to hundreds of billions. And that was simply, if you put money into our platform, apart from getting some interest income, you will also earn piece of our business, which in that case is tokens rather than equity. But it's like you keep money in the bank, and apart from paying you 10 basis points a year, your bank also gives you equity. And that became just a frenzy of people rushing to make money. And at that point in time, I was thinking, is it sustainable? Is it real? Will it last for a few weeks and will it die off? And now the way how I rationalize it in my mind, because, you know, I've been pretty much doing this full time for the last few years, it's bootstrapping early growth. So if you're a large company or a startup, you are likely to spend a lot of money paying for marketing, and the Facebooks of this world will eat away a lot of that margin. Or you will go to consultants or whatever else, and you would get these, you know, QA groups, user testers, or maybe even hire these people internally. Instead, what you can do is you can offer your token rewards and people will flock towards you. So the use case that I think it fit for those who are not kind of ideologically driven to the space was an ability to be paid to do what you like. So if you're someone who writes blog posts and you like doing that, and you're passionate about some crypto game or NFTs or DeFi, go write whatever you like and you'll get paid. If you want to build some code, go build that code and you'll get paid with tokens. You're just someone who likes playing video games with real money. Go and play with DeFi and deposit your coins and so on and so forth. And then as that starts to mature and materialize, you then need to bring in market makers and more professional firms, Re7 being one of them, that, you know, play in that market professionally. So I think it's a use case, as silly as it's going to sound, of financial freedom. And then on top of that, you know, once it becomes actually scalable, then it's a use case to very easily make payments, which is a very underrated use case, but a very vital one, as well as just getting leverage and participating in this digital economy.
You mentioned, you characterized it as financial freedom. I use the word financial inclusion, and they are pretty much the same thing. Why don't we talk about your firm now? What's one line definition of Re7 Capital?
That's a good one. So I would say that, you know, one liner would be, we're DeFi power users. So our job is to use DeFi, you know, to be lenders, to be borrowers, to be market makers, and do many other different things to ultimately generate some investment returns for our investors.
And how did it evolve in the recent past? What was the inception like? Is what Re7 Capital today is? Is it how you imagined it would be when you started it?
Well, I thought it would be easier, I can tell you that. No, it's pretty much moving along the roadmap that we envisioned. And this really goes back to the early days of DeFi summer in 2020, when stablecoins started to really grow in DeFi. And, you know, a lot of our listeners probably know what stablecoins are, but in a nutshell, these are not currencies. This is basically debt that is issued by a blockchain protocol or by a centralized company like Circle or Tether. And then you hold this asset, which should ideally or theoretically always be redeemable for $1, assuming they have enough reserves to back it up. And at that point in time, DeFi was offering, you know, 60% yields. And obviously, this is not financial advice, you know, needless to say. So at that time, it felt like a no-brainer to launch what is effectively like a high-yield credit risk style fund, where you take on this credit risk and then you go and you try to make double-digit returns. So it obviously has evolved and matured a lot. When we went live a bit more than a year ago, I remember there were probably 20 or 30 actionable DeFi platforms for us, realistically. And now, you know, we have a team of several analysts, data engineers, and we're barely keeping up because there are so many popping up right, left, and center, and a lot of them are really good.
We already started to see this, you know, blue chip DeFi protocols. Mm-hmm. It goes back to the point we discussed in the beginning that it's a validation of the mm-hmm. fact that DeFi works. And yeah. These protocols who've been early in the space, Aave, Compound, Uniswap, etc., they're already very well established projects.
That's right. Well, occasionally people do question it when, you know, when they risky comes up, but you're right. These platforms, you know, have $20 billion each roughly sitting on deposits there. So clearly people are comfortable. I think Compound was the first DeFi platform to get a rating from S&P, which is a meaningful achievement. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are definitely different shades of gray and different degrees of risk in the market. And yeah, the job of a professional market participant is to differentiate between the AAAs and the CCCs.
And I don't want you to give away your alpha. Your investors wouldn't like it if you did on this show. But what's the most interesting set of investing strategies right now on your end? And maybe you can use this question to talk about the strategies broadly as well, as to what sort of assets, what sort of projects you typically look at.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, DeFi means different things to different people, right? So DeFi is effectively an industry. So when you have someone in traditional financial markets and you ask them, what's your financial strategy? It can mean many different things. So realistically, people who operate in DeFi, they can buy these tokens of various platforms, hoping they will appreciate in value, which is like, you know, hedge fund long only, or even venture capital strategy. You then have people who do arbitrage and seek specific mispricings across different blockchains and so on and so forth, which like high frequency trading, basically. And then you have liquidity providers in the space, right? So people who go and they use these different platforms and they earn yield for doing so. And then you have different, you know, degrees of specialization within that. So we focus on market neutral strategies where effectively we generate yield from DeFi without taking on the price risk. So if the market goes down or if the market goes up, this in theory should not affect our performance. You know, obviously it's not risk-free and we take specific risks, but they're not related to the market movements. And, you know, a few things I'm really excited about as kind of strategies over the long run in DeFi are probably around derivatives, because we have built in DeFi a very established market for trading just kind of Delta One normal tokens. And it's quite inefficient, arguably, but it's decent. But when I look at options protocols, for example, we're so early. And there's so much more that needs to be done. I think people who understand these things very early, they're probably well positioned to capitalize on. That's kind of my financial logic. With my more technical or just, you know, kind of DeFi degen logic, I would be really, really excited about on the technical side, if we can get a really solid cross-chain bridging infrastructure. We have these different blockchains. Every blockchain is like an island, and every island is connected with a set of bridges. And so far, a lot of bridges, unfortunately, have been breaking down because they're just very, very hard to build in this industry. So I think once we get that infrastructure to really work, it will open up some amazing use cases. You know, I think it's not impossible to imagine that there's going to be a specific blockchain that will only be doing NFTs and some other blockchain that will only be doing order book trading for derivatives. And if they can all talk to each other through a set of bridges, that's where you get a really scalable future for crypto.
Absolutely. And I think what you're alluding to, Evgeny, is a multi-chain future, which I guess a lot of us agree at this point. So if you stay on your strategy and on the way you invest, what is a top priority on your due diligence checklist? Maybe a few items as well.
Yeah, so, you know, as much as I had tried to unlearn everything from TradFi, desire to not lose money stays with you forever. And because we operate in a yield style mentality, we need to be very risk centric. The first thing we do is the smart contract risk assessment. So it's looking at the DeFi platform saying it's a lending marketplace. We can be a lender on this platform and we can generate some phenomenal returns. That's amazing. Now let's understand if they can be hacked. And that requires doing a lot of work at the technical level, assessing the quality of the code, going through a specific set of checks and doing some specific analysis. And at the end of that process, unfortunately, you can't come out and say, this is definitely safe. What you can do, however, if you have enough experience, you can rank it with a certain degree of confidence. So you can say, well, this is, you know, we give this 90 points out of 100 or 10 points out of 100. With obvious implications for sizing of your position. So that's probably where we spend most of our time.
Looks like if you wanted to, you could actually build an audit firm, smart contract audit firm on the side, Evgeny.
That's too much pressure.
You have that capacity in the team.
You know what? We thought about something like this, but it's probably too much pressure. With audit firms, it's a bit tricky to do so because if you're an audit firm, you have a lot of responsibility.
Right.
And you're an audit firm and you put out the flag saying, we audited these guys and we haven't found any issues. And then, you know, I go and put all of my money there and I lose everything because those guys missed something. That's not very comfortable. We feel a little bit more comfortable when we can at least control the size of our position.
Sure.
So we know that if we're wrong on a few specific things, it will be contained at our portfolio level. But, you know, every time there are some hacks in the space and I read some of the stories, it gets quite heartbreaking because you have people who assume everything is safe and they lose their life savings. And I definitely don't want to take that emotional pressure.
Of course, you don't want to underwrite that scenario.
No, probably not.
Obviously. So, Evgeny, I want to talk about with you a little bit on, you know, the sustainability of returns in crypto. Hence, crypto as this new asset class. What are your views there? Obviously, in the early days of something new, there's always a lot of arbitrage opportunities, a lot of inefficiency in the system, hence huge returns for people who spot that opportunity early. But in the long run, as it would be in any market working efficiently, you would expect those arbitrage opportunities to disappear, hence returns to normalize, etc. So how do we know, though, what is sustainable, what is not in today's crypto market?
That's the most favorite questions my investors ask me. So spot on. Yeah, you're obviously right in terms of the logic, right? You have these abnormal returns which fade away over time. And like any type of investment strategy, you know, you have a risk premium associated with it. So the way how I personally think about, you know, market neutral yields in DeFi, I think they should trade at a certain spread above high yield bonds in the US or something like that as a benchmark. And what I mean by that is from a statistical risk perspective, some of the risks we take are very similar to a high yield bond in a sense where something can, you know, we're making X percentage per year, but then something can blow up at some point in the future. So you kind of, you know, you sell the tail risk and you get paid for it, which is a very classical logic in finance. But what we do is really from a technical level, right? If you are some very smart firm on Wall Street and you want to get into the space, it will take you a long time, relatively long time, to build your expertise and infrastructure to execute things and to build that knowledge base. And yeah, of course you can do it, but it'll take you a few years and you will have certain internal, you know, compliance and bureaucratic kind of procedural pressure against it. So this technical barrier, I think, will continue to exist and will justify this additional risk premium. And also what I've seen in crypto, and I made the same mistake, you know, when I started kind of jumping into it in 2015, 16, I felt I was too late because there were so many people who were smarter and deeper than me in the space. And actually, the more time goes by, the more I realize how early it really is. It's not early in the sense that, yeah, everyone in the world knows what Bitcoin is. But it's really early from the quality of infrastructure and from the maturity level. So we see a lot of inefficiencies even in this market, which is relatively mature. And so far, it looks like they will continue. What happens, though, is your strategy needs to mature. I remember 4 years ago, there was a period of time where there was a Korean premium associated with Bitcoin. So you buy it in the US, you sell it in Korea, and you make 5%. Now, obviously, you don't have these spreads on some easy trades, but you have some other spreads which are still reasonable and that still can generate higher rate of return than on a risk-adjusted basis. Absolutely. As long as you continue to innovate on your investment strategy.
What do you make of the current market conditions in crypto? Are we in a hard winter or mild winter? Or are we in a winter? Obviously, feel free to challenge that.
Well, that's a trillion-dollar question, isn't it? Yeah, historically, crypto has been very cyclical, where you have two good years, three bad years, and that sort of thing. So far, all the data is pointing towards exactly the same cycle as before. On the other hand, you have a more mature technical layer with real products, with real users, and with real revenue, which should make this cycle a shorter one. However, you know, I'm no macro expert by any means, but I'm pretty sure no matter what country our listeners are in, everyone experienced inflation this year. So I think when you have a major part of population heavily exposed to inflation and often stagnating income, it's unrealistic to expect for people to again start gambling with their hard-earned money on some digital tokens and go and play in DeFi or in Metaverse. I think until those kind of living conditions improve, it's probably not very realistic to expect a huge wave of people to just rush back in, unless you're talking about some fascinating game or fascinating social media use case or something like that. So I guess these things kind of net each other out, but also, you know, winter means different things to different people. And even if, you know, all the tokens in the world go down 50% or more, but people continue to use the products, then actually I don't see it as a big problem, because those who are building their businesses in this industry can still do very well, even if the overall market is not very supportive of high valuations.
And I think the other thing that we need to keep in mind when we look at current winter or period, whatever we call it, is that the traditional markets are different from where they were previous crypto winters. It's now different from that perspective as well. And on top of that, crypto was separated from traditional markets for a long time. And now in the last, you know, maybe a couple of years or so, we were seeing more and more alignment. Where do you think we are on that cycle in terms of them moving together? I guess it was largely driven by the increasing retail demand in crypto. How do you think that where we are and how do you think that would evolve in the short to midterm?
Yeah, I think we're clearly very intertwined with NASDAQ. If we just look at historical correlations, they're very high, especially in the downward market, which is very normal. All correlation goes to one in an environment like this. When I think about crypto, I think about it as it's a sector of a tech economy, and therefore, I would argue it should be correlated to the real world, so to speak, because if, you know, Robinhood or Coinbase or something like that goes down in value, why shouldn't some tokens? So this correlation will probably continue to exist. But I think an important, exciting feature of this industry is that if you get things right, that's really what I'm kind of hoping for, that even the overall economy isn't doing well and valuations are stagnating and it's just very painful, if you can build a business that can grow up 1,000x because it's just great, then you'll be okay. Maybe you will not get a quick exit, or maybe it's not going to be a huge exit, but you'll do okay. And crypto clearly has potential for those projects to scale and to succeed.
I think that was a great point to maybe close up, but I have two more questions before that. So the first one is, if everything goes to plan, what do you want to make out of Resaving Capital?
Ooh, that's a good question. I would probably like us to become even more technical than we are today, and be able to really support DeFi's growth for the next many, many years to come, right? So just like you have crucial pieces of financial industry and financial infrastructure, I would just love to be one of those teams that are at the forefront of this global innovation.
Awesome. That's a great mission. Sounds exciting. And I have this closing question that I ask everyone. What are you most curious about these days? And what are you doing to learn more about it?
That's a good question. The thing which I understand very little about right now is this thing in crypto called ZK rollups, you know, zero knowledge proof and those things where you can basically build on top of a public blockchain, but obfuscate some of the things that you do, which makes it more acceptable towards traditional financial institutions. And I don't understand it well enough, and I have to keep learning because it's a really complex kind of thing to grasp from a technical perspective. But it's really fascinating because it allows you to play a lot of game theory experiments, which I find fascinating.
Awesome. So ZK rollups is your bedtime reading then?
Pretty much, yeah.
Awesome. So Evgeny, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you very much for making the time and sharing your fascinating background and experience with the early days of crypto and also with building Resaving Capital.
Thank you.